Gregoire and Dan Beeston are smart enough to know better.
Welcome to episode 215 of Smart Enough to Know Better.
We are a podcast of science
and comedy
and ignorance.
I'm Dan Beeston.
I'm Gregoire.
And in this episode, would you like me to warm some blood up for you?
Bird. Is bird the word?
And then I switch to decaf, and not a moment too soon.
But Dan, before all that, tell me all about your week in science.
I don't have a week in science, Gregoire.
Good.
Because the automation game Satisfactory launched, and every single spare moment of my time is going towards it. I haven't experienced anything else.
I was aware of this, by the way, through Girl Clumsy Natalie Bohensky from the Raven On podcast. When she was when I asked, how's Dan going? She went, he's found something, some sort of factory game. He's doing some factory. He went, it's Satisfactory. I think that's what it's called. It's all he talked about. Nice.
So, yeah, no, I've put a lot of resources in my brain towards it, and eventually that'll all free up for something else. But at the moment, I am 100% on board a very unhelpful boat. So what happened to you this week in science, Gregoire?
Well, I have to ask a question, Dan. How many moons does Earth have?
Just the one. And look, and that's not there all the time. Sometimes it's somewhere else.
What? No, the moon. The moon.
The moon, yeah. I look up, moon, I see it, but then sometimes it's just not there.
Oh, right. It's always there, Dan. It's always there.
It's not always there. Sometimes
it's like
you go
Jesus,
out
Dan. It's like Jesus. Only just because you don't see the footprints, it was carrying you. The moon was carrying you, Dan. So you are 100% correct. Well done. We have one moon. Yes, that's it. That was the there was. And they were expecting multiple moons. No.
Well, that was a quick one.
We've talked about this on the podcast before. There have been other things, you know, around the Earth, but actually, well, I may be wrong. Depends on when you listen to this podcast, dear listener. If you listen to this podcast between September 29th of 2024 and November 25th, 2024, you could technically say we had two moons.
But what's a moon then? Because I know what a satellite is.
Well, a moon is sort of a natural satellite, yes.
Yeah.
So it's something called 2024 PT5. It is a near-Earth asteroid, and it's part of the Juno asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. There is the asteroid belt, and it comes from these clusters of asteroids. And it's kind of this group of asteroids are sort of in resonance with the Earth. They're not in orbit around each other. Due to the Earth's gravitational field knocking them all around, they have a resonance. They can go back to the same position. And this one, PT, as I said before, is 2024 PT5, sort of got a little bit too close to the Earth by millions of kilometers, not like super close, and like well past the moon, the actual moon's Collins orbit. And it's come in September 29th, this mini moon, this thing that is only 11 meters across. It's tiny, tiny, tiny asteroid.
Oh my goodness, it's like little prince sized.
That's right, you just sit on top of it. It's going to go into a quasi-orbit, well, into an orbit, but into a very elliptical orbit until November, and then it will go back on its merry way. So for that time, we have a mini-moon. It'll be in orbit around, and it is in orbit around the Earth, and then once it gets sort of kicked out again, it will go back to being in orbit around the Sun. But we will have another quasi-moon. Sorry, a mini-moon, not a quasi-moon, a mini-moon.
How do you find something that's 11 meters across?
Not easily. There are lots of radars out there, some radars out there looking for things that are going to hit the Earth for this exact reason. Yet you won't be able to see it with the naked eye, even when it gets closest to the Earth, like in January. It gets back being close to the Earth, though not in orbit around the Earth. You will not see it with the naked eye. You won't even see it with a backyard telescope. You need something like 30 meters across to see it physically, like a massive telescope. This is a tiny, dark object in a very dark sky. So radar is the key. Bouncing invisible light off it, Dan, just to annoy you.
What's it made of?
Rock.
Rock.
Asteroids, rock. It's the asteroid belt. So it's not, as far as I'm aware, it's not ice at all. It's not a comet or anything like that. It hasn't got comedy kind of feels to it. It's definitely just a big old rock. So
if it hit our atmosphere, would it make it to the ground?
11 meters. Yes. Yeah, 11 meters would. Yeah, I think I like to think that it depends on how shallow an angle it came in and how fast it was moving. I can't say that, but yes, it could make it down. If something 11 meters hit us, it hit near you, you wouldn't want to be there. Yeah, it's not going to be like a dinosaur killer. That's like kilometers across, but that's, you know, a world-ending event. This could be, I wouldn't say a city killer, because I think that needs to be like 100 meters across or so. This is pretty tiny. It would make a hell of a crater.
It wouldn't, so it wouldn't burn up to the size of a chihuahua's head?
Probably not. No, I don't think so. What it's made out of, depending if it's, I mean, it could just fall apart, of course. That's the thing. We don't 100% know if it's a big rubble pile or if it's like a big lump of, it's not like a lump of iron, but if it's going to be sort of, you know, but I would say, yes, it would hit the ground depending on how steeply it came through the atmosphere. And how,
I guess it all depends on how fast these things are going, yes, in relation, yeah, to us. Like if you had one that just sort of that was traveling really fast compared to like the other side of the galaxy, but just happened to be going about the same speed as the Earth and just, oh, sort, yes, of tangented it in and like and slowly just came in and then just dropped, it'd just sort of go thud like a,
yeah,
big old, well, rock.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to explode like a and to cause volcanoes.
If you have a exact relative to the Earth is where we talk about when we talk about the velocity hitting the ground. We're not worrying about like it's, yes, if you're because we are whipping around the center of the galaxy. We don't take that into account. We're saying relative to the Earth, this thing would have, you know, if it comes in slow enough, it will have more chance of hitting the ground. Also more chance of being captured. We've talked about other mini moons before on the podcast many years ago. So in 2006, there was RH120, and that was a small asteroid the size of a car, which lasted for just under a year. And 2020, there's one called CD3.
I've had cars that lasted just under a year.
There was 2020 CD3, so it also, in February 2020, and it lasted for about 3 years. So right during all the COVID excitement, it was sort of doing its thing before it was ejected. And these were all mini moons, actual moons. But there's quasi moons as well, which is pretty cool. So quasi moons are objects out there that look like they go into orbit around the Earth, or look like they are in orbit around the Earth, but actually are in orbit around the Sun. They're moving in a resonance with the Earth. So sometimes it goes ahead and then the Earth catches up with it and it looks like, oh, it's going around us. Well, no, it's going around the Sun. We just happen to be there.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. There's one called Kamaloa. So it shares the Earth orbit, doesn't fully orbit the Earth, and follows more of a complex path around the Sun. But it's a quasi-moon, because if you look at it just from the Earth point of view, you go, that thing's going around us. It's definitely looking around us. When you pull back a bit and take the solar system into account, you go, it's definitely orbiting the Sun. Mm. We just happen to be there. That's just...
Like, we're dancing around the Sun.
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And that quasi-moon is not even looking at us. It's got only eyes for the Sun. We just happen to get in the way sometimes.
It's like if we're driving, we're in a race, mm-hmm, and we're both in our cars and I drive and then you overtake me on the outside and, mm, then I overtake you on the outside.
Yes.
We're not orbiting each other.
No.
We're orbiting the track. We're, yes, going around the track. We just happen to be...
There it is.
Overtaking exactly. One end and I'm overtaking the other end.
If we were just NASCAR drivers going around and around the same track, that's a very good point. We're orbiting the center of the track, just passing each other on the outside each time. So from one of our points of view, you can go, Dan's going around me. No, we're just both going around the same point. So, yeah.
Because everyone has great mass, that we're all affecting each other.
They're definitely, and that's the thing. With quasi-moons, especially something even, you know, the Earth is so big comparatively, we're definitely changing the orbits of this thing. That's why we can capture mini moons or go into resonance with quasi moons, but they wouldn't really affect the Earth because the Earth is so much bigger. I mean, it is, but not on any appreciable level. And the Sun's much bigger than both of those things. So the Sun's like,
nah, it's tiny. I go outside, it's not there all the time.
And it's very far away. So, you know, being close sometimes you can have much more impact. In science as well as relationships and politics. I don't know. But yeah, sometimes being close to things gives you more power than more powerful things further away.
I bet there are some people in Russian villages who feel the same way. Do you remember the first science you ever learned?
No. I've learned so much science, Dan. I can't be expected to learn it all.
Not string theory.
No. What was the first science I learned? I have strong memories of Halley's Comet, but that's far too late in my life to say that's the first one I learned. No, I can't. I couldn't tell you.
I probably can't remember properly too, but I think one of the first things I'd learned as being a science thing was that mammals had warm blood. Ooh. And reptiles had cold blood.
Ooh.
This was important stuff to a five-year-old. I had dinosaurs to incorrectly categorize. I knew amphibians and reptiles were cold-blooded and birds and mammals were warm-blooded. Mammals could run around at night because they created their warmth chemically, and reptiles had to come out during the day to heat up.
Right.
And if they got too cold, they went into torpor and they couldn't move until they heated up again. I have known these facts for over 40 years. And you know what I never questioned until this podcast, Gregoire?
Right. What's that?
Why do we need warm blood?
Ooh.
Now, I know why we need unfrozen blood.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it needs to be liquid. Transporting oxygen to your muscles gets very difficult if your blood is a solid or a gas.
Yeah. In the science fiction Hail Mary, in that the alien in that would actually ingest a block of nutrients basically it was nutrients that it would then use to power itself entirely. And then it would eject that same used up block. So it could survive in space. So it did actually use a solid thing that it then drew nutrients out of.
Oh. But how did the nutrients get around its body?
I either don't remember it or they never went into it in the book. It's the same guy who did The Martian, so I'm pretty certain they probably did talk about it. I was probably just drunk at the time or looked away or something. I can't remember.
Number two, if ice crystals form in cells, it breaks the cell membrane and your animal becomes mushy. There is a creature called an Arctic snailfish. It lives in the crevices of icebergs.
Right.
So these little guys are chock full of antifreeze proteins and their blood can drop in temperature very low indeed.
Yeah.
Because there's a sub-zero point where seawater is below freezing, but it doesn't freeze because it's seawater.
Yeah, yeah. But also it's pressure as well. If you're in a very high pressure environment, then you'd have to lower the temperature even more. So to freeze it into a solid, it's pressure versus temperature. There's a pressure. There's a diagram.
Yeah. Otherwise, the bottom of the ocean, it'd all be ice, I guess.
Well, ice also floats. We've talked about it before. Ice is weird. Water is weird. When it freezes, it becomes less dense.
That would be a dynamic system, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The pressure's too much. The ice freezes, floats to the top.
Yeah.
And then it all goes.
Circulates.
And then the bottom freezes again, and it just keeps lifting, but it can't get past itself.
In the end,
I had to do all my head in. Probably for the best that the universe works like it does. Yeah. So mammals have warm blood, and they also have not too warm blood. If our temperature increases too much, we get hypothermia, and if it decreases, we go into hypothermia.
Mm.
And it's a very small band of temperature in which we don't die. It's like a handful of kelvins.
Yes. Yep, yep.
The same goes for reptiles. If they get too hot, they die. If they get too cold, they can't move. They regulate their temperature by moving closer to or away from warm areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the same thing mammals are doing, but a manual process. They lie in the sun or they bury themselves in the ground. This behavior is governed by their hormones. They just do it. They're like, it gets too cold and they're like, got a sunbake.
Yep, yep. We've all been there.
If you have a pet lizard, you need to provide a warm spot and a cool spot in their environment or the lizard can't adjust its temperature and it can get sick. Or in danger.
Yeah. If it's always just warm, it would just continually warm up and die in the end. It would overheat.
Yeah.
And die. Yeah.
So it needs to live inside a heat gradient.
Yeah. And it needs to be able to move around that heat gradient.
Yeah.
As it chooses to. Yeah.
Now, mammals need their food to digest quickly to access as much energy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So food breaks down chemically when it's warm. So 40 degrees is like the perfect temperature for food to break down.
Yeah.
Anything higher than this, and the enzyme that breaks down the starch denatures and stops working properly and won't break down the carbohydrates. So it's like the intersection of two opposing forces.
Yeah. You can't get more efficient to break down your food because your body breaks down at that point.
Yeah. You would need to create an enzyme that was more resilient.
Yeah. And I guess that could evolve. That could be something, obviously it did evolve at one point to be what we are, but it becomes less favorable. The energy it takes to make that thing is probably too high to go any higher to be more efficient. You're on a losing streak at that point. So therefore creatures aren't going to become more higher temperature because to create the enzyme would, I assume, take a lot more energy than what we have. So you're losing more energy than you're actually making in the end.
Also, you need to up your amount of you need to up your metabolism in order to maintain that heat.
Yes. Yeah. Good point. Yeah, the fuel in, you're burning more fuel to keep. Yeah. So in the end, there's that you're not gaining anything out of it to do a lot extra work.
Yeah. So mammals are perfectly positioned to break down food at the fastest rate. Reptiles digest their food slowly. They don't use any chemical means to maintain their metabolism. Their food all goes to growth, so they need much less and over a much longer time. So this is all well and good, but why does it matter that creatures maintain a certain temperature? Why can't they bounce up and down the temperature scale? Like, wouldn't you love to be able to like live in like volcanoes and then live in the Arctic and not need to dress in like asbestos cloaks or...
Why can't I just say, I'm in a very cold environment. I need to up my temperature now by 10 degrees internally. Just go, we kind of do. No.
What I'm saying is why can't you go to a cold environment and just be like, I'm comfortable now. I'll just drop my body temperature.
Right. Yes. I'm going to guess the same. Here's my guess on this. You just talk about the processing of food. Your whole body is chemistry. So how your brain operates and how all the other important functions of your body work are all based on chemicals and enzymes and chemical processes that require...
There's a lot going on. It's a whole dance.
Yeah, so you're going to need a certain band of temperature to operate the way we operate.
Well, that you've hit the nail right on the head, Craig. Temperature is crucial to how chemistry works because chemistry is all about molecules moving.
Yep.
If the temperature is higher, the molecules are moving faster. If we have impulse conduction through potassium channels and they slow down or speed up, then they're not going to work right and how the rest of our body expects it to work. And there's like a thousand of these processes that are all sort of honed to do everything in hand with each other. And if they're speeding up and slowing down, it's a mess.
Mm.
So to summarize, organisms don't need to be warm to live. They just need to stay in a fairly narrow band of temperature. And if they don't, all the internal clockwork gets thrown off and the system stops working.
Yeah. I have a question then. When mammals evolved originally, so you're talking back
Years ago, I'd imagine.
At least a few years ago. I don't know exactly when, but it's before the dinosaurs wiped out. Mammals existed then, small little mammaly things. But I don't know how much before, like 65 million years ago. So I'm going to say, top of my head, 5 million years before that. It could be a lot more, but let's just say that. Where did they evolve? I don't think
maybe it was like at the exact same time. The dinosaurs are like looking down. They're like, the fuck is that? And they look up and like, the fuck is that?
Who's this hairy bastard? Boom. Pretty certain there's been little mammals have been found eaten by dinosaurs. But they were small. They were like no bigger than like a badger or something like that, which is relatively big actually. But I think at that point, mammals hadn't gone past that stage, I think. But I'm wondering where they evolved. And what temperature, like, was it on the equator? Was it in a temperate zone? And I know that this would have changed over time as the mammals evolved and different mammals came into existence. Where mammals first evolved set the temperature that we like to work at as mammals. Did we, if we evolved in the Arctic, surely we would be built for colder temperatures, though evolution would state that as you moved around, you could be in different places. Or am I totally
mammals
wrong?
Mammals are more dynamic in where they can go. Like reptiles can only go from the equator and then a certain distance. Whereas
in my mind, that means that I feel you're right there. So the mammal has a bigger ceiling and floor for environmental temperature can survive in. That's a huge evolutionary advantage.
Yeah.
But it's still a ceiling and a floor. So I wonder if that ceiling and the floor is set by where it originally evolved, or maybe it's just changed over time and scooted up or down based on where they were.
Yeah. Well, fish are all over the shop. Fish can live in moderately warm water and then in freezing cold water.
Yes. Yeah. And that's it. And also birds. Birds have a higher temperature, body temperature than humans do. So they're warm blooded. And even some mammals, I can't remember what it's called, thermo or other, basically your choice. Like cats, domestic cats have preference. Like we have human beings have a preference about 23 degrees.
Yep.
Where a domestic cat has a preference for 28 to 30 degrees, if I remember correctly.
They evolved in the desert.
They want to be warmer. For us, we're like, what a lovely temperature. The cat's like, a bit chilly in here. That's why cats,
might go lie in a sunbeam or on your laptop.
what's wrong with this cat? Why is it, it's, you know, and they go, oh, it's 30 degrees. This is great. Thanks,
everyone. Which is why these people who leave their air conditioners on all day for their cats at home are like, oh, everyone's just pissing their money away at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
No one's happy.
It's okay if, like, you know, if you live in a dangerous temperature area, but if you're dropping it down to 18 degrees, your cat's like, oh my God, it's cold. Now it can live in it, obviously, but it doesn't prefer it. So that could be a change as well. Preference versus range.
Yeah. Doesn't prefer it.
Oh, very good. A positive ending to your comments.
Oh no, come on, let's be better than puns.
Wait. And the idea that dinosaurs were probably not hot blooded, but like warm blooded. Cool-blooded. Yeah, warm blooded, but like there's evidence now that maybe some dinosaurs did have some level of thermoregulation, or maybe they all did. And maybe it wasn't as high. Maybe they could just keep their body away from really horribly small, like really low temperatures that would kill them. But they didn't have our ability to do what we do. But they might have had some ability to regulate, like sauropsids. I think it's where mammals came from. There's all this like, oh, wait, is that was it a mammal thing or not? Like the idea of back when you and I were boys, it was like, oh, the big dumb dinosaur was all big and dumb, and it hung out slowly, and it lived in a big old pond, and it ate leaves, and sometimes got killed by
a second brain to control its back end.
Yeah, that's right. And it was like, and then big old T-Rex came and killed it, and then ate it slowly. It was all a bit slow and boring. Even like maybe it was a scavenger. Maybe T-Rex just found dead things in swamps and ate them. And you're like, oh, that's terrible. And then it was like, oh no, these were agile predators with feathers, and you know, some of them were.
T-Rexes didn't have feathers.
I know T-Rexes. Sorry, T-Rexes I meant didn't have feathers. I wasn't saying to annoy you. I'm sorry.
T-Rex is still cool,
but they may have been warm-blooded in some way. There was these things. Yeah, it's not cut and dried, baby. Not cut and dried. Dan, you are in a beautiful forest, an ancient.
Visualize. Hang on. Yes. I am not in a beautiful forest, and it's going to require a little bit of theater of the mind for me to get there.
Let me give you some more data so you know what sort of forest you're in.
All right.
Just let me do my thing.
Too late. I'm in a candy forest now. Made a mistake. I've taken a wrong turn.
Taking a very wrong turn. You're in a beautiful ancient forest. You can smell the resin of these conifers. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous forest. You're walking through it, pushing past all the trees and the bracken on the floor. There's quite a bit of a
pretty idyllic.
It's very idyllic. There's quite a bit of bracken on the ground. So, you know, like
bracken. Now that's like that's like leaves that's getting all mushed up.
Yeah,
right?
Mushed up leaves and dry leaves, and you've got pine needles all over the ground and other little shrubs that are growing up. So just a leaf
litter everywhere. Oh, those nasty little spiky seeds that you get under conifers.
Definitely little cones. And you say, but you enjoy, it smells beautiful, and you find a clearing. Sunlight's going, a tree's collapsed.
A glade.
A tree has collapsed and knocked a few other trees down, and the sunlight's streaming in, and other little trees are popping up, and you decide to rest on this log. You're sitting there on the log.
Oh, I feel like I'm about to get visited by something from Shakespeare.
Well, yeah, you're almost right. And you hear a weird noise, like some sort of strangled cry of an animal, and you look up, and there's this beautiful orange and red bird. And it flies down, and it's majestic, absolutely majestic. It lands on the log about 2 or 3 meters from you, and it's sort of cocking its head. There's something weird about this bird, but you're not too sure what it is. It's cocking its head side to side, and it looks at you, and it looks around, and then suddenly it bursts into flame and ignites the log and ignites the leaf litter and ignites you, and everything is on fire, and you're running around like a crazy person. And you've just met the phoenix.
Oh, no.
Sasquatch or Bigfoot, who is who? It's all going down at the Crypto Zoo.
All right, so phoenixes burst into flames. It's not just when they die. That is them dying. They rise from the ashes.
That's true. Now
they just pop into flames, and then they're a baby phoenix coming out of
the
ashes.
The idea, yes. We'll talk about phoenix for a bit in mythologies. The Greeks talked about the phoenix, and it would live for many, many, many years, and near the end of its life, it would go make a little nest, and it would self-immolate, and from the ashes, a new phoenix would be born. That's the Greek story.
Yeah.
There is also a Chinese story as well, so an animal that would burn itself and live forever. This perpetual rebirth of heat and fire. But we're going mainly for the Greek concept of the phoenix at this point, though they're all kind of similar. It seems to be this, even Christian mythology talked about phoenixes for a while. Early mythology was talking, you know.
Well, their body heat's so high. It's like Fahrenheit 541, but it's like avian 43.
Higher than that.
Boom. So I was trying to work out temperature do birds spontaneously burst into flame? It's time for a smart enough, no better experiment.
And I was trying to work out how would a phoenix actually work in the real world? What is a phoenix? How would it work? How does any of this even vaguely work? That's my theory here.
Well, what we need to do is find a parallel for an animal that can make fire. Like, yes. And there's not a lot of that out there. Like, dragons aren't real, are they?
Not as far as we're aware. No.
There is the bombardier beetle.
That's
a creature that has one type of thing inside it. That is one chemical, and one thing is another chemical, and then it spits them out together. And when they mix, kaboom! So what you need for your phoenix is it in one crop, mm-hmm. it's got petroleum, and in the other crop, it's got styrofoam,
mm-hmm.
and that makes napalm. And then it just nicks its little beak, goes nick, and creates like a spark. So it's got a little flint beak, or maybe it eats flint because birds follow stones in their crop.
Yep.
Or the gizzard.
Gizzard. Oh, yeah, in the gizzard. Yeah, good point.
And so when those flints chip together and form a spark and it breathes some oxygen in, mixes with the napalm.
Explodes.
Kaboom. Bird on fire.
This seems like a very unhelpful adaption for an animal to come around to. A mistake.
Well, this is the goal. The end point is for the bird to catch fire and create a new bird. Because there is also a parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Octopuses, mother octopuses.
Light themselves on fire?
They do not. It's hard. That's hard to do under the sea.
Yep.
It's very difficult. Not impossible, but very difficult.
Very, very hard.
But a mother octopus will give birth to her little octopi, and then she will basically just, her death clock.
Octopuses, not octopi, octopuses. Remember, we talked about this on the podcast before. Octopus is a Greek word, and octopi would be Latinizing the Greek word. In English, it's octopuses. If we were going to Greek word it, it would be octopodes.
So octagon is a Latin word? We talked about the platypus.
No, we talked about octopuses. We talked about octopuses before as well.
All right, fair enough.
It's definitely, it's not octopi. It's right. Not octopi.
Well, it's octopuses definitely platypodes. Or
octopodes, if you want to get real, real fancy, that no one does.
The little baby ones of them. this is the Kelvin thing all over again.
I'm getting you back.
So the mummy octopus has like a death clock and just goes, I'm going to die. And then the little babies can like eat my flesh, and that gives them that first boost to go on. So there is a parallel in nature for the parent.
Well, I've heard about human mothers saying the same thing. They're just draining the life out of me, just my corpse, sucking it out of my money, but my credit card and my...
Not
good parent.
Gotcha.
Not good parents. Yes, so bombardier beetle. That's what I was thinking. I found that as well, bombardier beetles. Fire beetles. There's a thing called the fire beetle.
Ooh.
The fire beetle seeks out, reproduces in freshly burned areas. And so they actually have an infrared sensing. So they look for fires. And once the fire's gone through, they go land in the holes and everything made in the burnt out trees. And they lay their eggs in there. So they actually reproduce in just burnt up forests. They're not making the fire, but they are fire dependent.
There are birds that do make fire. Some birds have started picking up stuff that's on fire and carrying it and causing fires. Like very smart birds of prey will drop some fire in some dry grass, and all the vermin will run from the fire, and the bird will then pick them off.
That sounds like a plan.
So,
they've
been studied doing that. So that's a bird that benefits from fire.
Absolutely. The monarch butterfly, it consumes toxic milkweed as larvae, storing the toxins to deter predators. I was thinking I don't see why you couldn't have an animal ingest resins such as from a conifer, which is flammable, to actually store it up as a flammable substance inside its own body. So it could also eat it or ingest it in some way to get access to that flammable. You wouldn't have to make napalm is what I'm trying to say. there are flammable things in nature that it could store up.
There would be a benefit to a juvenile phoenix. Like it's not great if that's the only way they reproduce, is that the phoenix lays one phoenix egg and then dies.
Yeah.
Because then you're not replacing. Like, you need to rely on the occasional double yoker coming through.
That's a very good point as well. That's a big thing. Not just burning, but the idea of, in phoenix mythology, the idea that phoenix immolates and a new phoenix is born. That's very, very major part of the myth of it. So I think we need to keep that in mind as well. We could chat about change that later on, but that's an important part that I'd like to focus on. To me, that means a clone. That's a clone at that point. If you're making a new one and there's no daddy phoenix, you're cloning yourself. You destroy the parent and then the new one is born and it's a clone. And to begin with, I was like, oh, that's hard. That's really, really, really difficult. Well,
there's nothing there to say that they're not being, like, the female is not being inseminated by the male.
Yes.
And then, is it leaving an egg or is it leaving a baby bird?
It depends on the stories. So it immolates and dies and the phoenix rises from the ashes. I guess you could say there's an egg that rises from the ashes, but normally it's the phoenix rises from the ashes. But, you know, we can change that. We can decide. That could just be a nice metaphor. You know, an egg could be seen, but still an egg. I guess it could be sexually reproduced. They could have sex and then burn itself. I keep trying to work out, why is it burning itself though? So you might have to come back to that.
Well, I've got an idea.
Before we go off to sexual reproduction, if those possible, I was trying to work out, are there actually any animals that asexually reproduce through what's called parthenogenesis? The fact that something called parthenogenesis should tell us, yes, this does happen in nature. So in the absence of males.
Aphids.
Aphids, exactly. Aphids are definitely one of them. So they can do it as well. And so lots of insects, once again, some insects can do it, but even some bigger animals. So whiptail lizards, they are an entirely female species that reproduce via parthenogenesis, which I found really interesting. The whiptail lizard that does this is a hybrid of two other types of whiptail lizards. So it's not, it takes a whole other species to create this other species that then can reproduce by itself. It can also go sexual again if it needs to, but it doesn't have to. So in times of no partners, especially because there are no male versions of this animal because they're clones, it takes a male from another species that's close to theirs to breed with them.
Wow.
If they want to have sexually, but if they don't, if they haven't got them around, they can parthenogenically create more of themselves.
Nature is so horny.
It is, absolutely. Or not, it's not horny, and it's like, we're going to deal with this ourselves. So enough of your nonsense. I thought that'd be a problem with, well, you're not going to get any genetic diversity, but you can. You'd actually get, even though it's cloning, mistakes can happen, and that leads to genetic diversity in it as well. So it can actually happen over time. Or if you get occasionally a species comes in, or a close species comes and mates with it, it adds genetic diversity back again. But large animals, it seems, can actually do this as well. So I was like, okay, we've got animals that can self-immolate. It creates a new version of itself. But most of them, in my mind anyway, were insects. I kept coming back to insects. Not a lot of birds that do this. I'm not saying birds, it wouldn't be possible. But I was trying to find, what's the easiest way of doing this? Nearly everything we've talked about so far has been done by insects. So my theory is that phoenixes are not birds. They're an insect.
Ooh, like a big stick insect or something.
Like a big stick insect. So my first question there was, well, how big could it be? That was my, like,
Stick insects are massive. They're like a foot long.
Yeah, that's right. I was trying to look up how big. I've read, sometimes they say, because, you know, it's a made-up thing, 2 meters. I'm like, oh, no. Sometimes it was like 30 centimeters. Like, okay, this is a very big range. So I looked up the largest insects that have ever lived on planet Earth.
The Goliath something?
Oh, that's the heaviest. Goliath beetles.
Goliath beetle's the heaviest.
And I found the 70-centimeter dragonfly in the Carboniferous period, hundreds of millions of years ago, when the oxygen level of the Earth was 37%.
Ooh, that makes things easier to catch on fire, maybe.
There you go. You've got it. When this 37% oxygen is getting to a point where spontaneous fires would have been happening a butt ton, and any more, you'd start getting even higher and higher, like you'd just be burning all the time. Earth had almost reached its, and maybe that was the feedback loop. Everything was just going to burn at this point. It got much, much higher. So 35% oxygen allows for very big insects, very, very big insects. So my theory is phoenix is a 70 centimeter to 1 meter, that feels okay, butterfly-like creature that breeds parthenogenically and creates a clone of itself. So it actually burns itself alive. Because once again, butterflies have cocoons. Butterflies literally turn themselves into goo inside a cocoon as a larvae and then reemerge as a beautiful butterfly. So this butterfly, in my mind, this very large butterfly, when it ignites itself, we can discuss why later on, I have a theory on why, it's already created this cocoon inside its body. It's not trying to save all its body. It lets its resin-infused cells burn, ignites them, and there is a cocoon already inside its body protecting a little bag of stem cells and all the important bits and pieces it needs, like a, maybe a part of its spinal column, I don't know.
Gotcha.
No, spinal column, that's not what it, but you know, but its nervous system. When it burns, there are chitinous material and other proteins that harden in flame. Its cocoon, in my mind, is inside its own body, and as it's, as the parent dies and burns, it leaves a cocoon on the ground, which is very quickly can pupate and come out as the same creature. Well, not the same creature, but the genetic offspring of that creature. It steps away, it comes out, a smaller version, which it can then eat and it can feed. That's my theory so far.
That's pretty good, because butterflies don't live very long.
No.
And,
no.
And they've got to procreate. But like a baby butterfly has its whole life ahead of it. So yes. You kind of want to, if you want to recycle and get back to being young so that you can live longer. That's
and there are lots of animals. Also, there's the immortal jellyfish that does something similar. I mean, it doesn't just die, but the otanizes, goes back to being a baby and starts again.
We
don't think it keeps any memories or very few memories. Animals have done this. So this is kind of like Groot in the movie Guardians of the Galaxy. So Groot, spoilers, sacrifices himself to save everyone. And baby Groot is Groot, but isn't the same Groot. Isn't exactly, doesn't have all the memories, I think, of the original Groot. It has a slightly different personality. That's what we're talking about here. Basically, we're talking about Groot butterflies. But why? This is all great. This is all fantastic. So we've got this creature. It produces parthenogenically. It can ignite itself. But that's the question, is why? Why is it doing this?
Well, I got a good idea for that.
Yeah, why, okay, yes.
Some creatures live in very inhospitable places. And you're like, why on earth does this creature live in this inhospitable place? It's like, because the things that eat that creature won't go to that inhospitable place. So if you can make your young and put them in an environment where they're safe, but everything else is in danger, like say the middle of a forest fire, then that young is not going to have any predators around that aren't incinerated.
Exactly. Yeah, and you've cleared out any competition as well. So you've burnt basically exactly the same idea. So this the phoenix butterfly goes to a forest, lands, sets it on fire. Nothing's going to be around. It's in all the vermin run away, so you're not going to have any animals trying to eat the baby. No predators are going to be there to eat the baby. Only other versions of itself will be around. Only thing that can survive. So if one lights itself on fire and another one gets caught in that fire, it probably goes, oh, well, as long as it's ready to go, it can also then start a fire and go as well. So you probably get a kickoff, and it just burns the forest down. And it burns everything around it, and all those nutrients, all those wonderful nutrients go in the soil, leading to more regrowth, leading to, you know, everything to grow back. And it's ready. It's already there. And as long as it can pupate quickly and get out into the world and grow and eat, it's got an advantage before everything else moves back into the burnt up forest. The phoenix butterfly is already there. So, and it's living its best life.
I imagine that there's a perfect environment for a symbiotic relationship with something like a gum tree that benefits from catch and fire and then getting all that new growth.
And my God, we've been working on this for far too long. It's hilarious you just said that. Because I was thinking of the thing, oh, it burns the forest down. I went, exactly what you said then. There are trees that need fire to reproduce. Everything you just said then. There are whole trees that wait for that to crack open that their pods. It requires fire.
So and their flowers would probably be attractive to the butterflies.
Exactly. And I was thinking, this becomes a mutualistic relationship now. So you've got this conifer, because I wanted the resin, and the phoenix butterfly, because you need a lot of energy to do this. This is ridiculous. We're talking about burning a thing to death itself and then rising from the fire whenever it requires. It's a lot of energy. So it needs a very, very high energy sap. If this tree puts out a really high energy sap / resin as well, that gives the butterfly the energy to do what it needs to do, and also gives the tree the ability to burn down the forest anytime it basically its friends turn up. If it's set up for this and ready to go, then it gets its seeds spread out across the world, much where nothing else is there. So its whole forest just takes over. So it helps both the animal and the plant. And this also led me to, how does the phoenix butterfly get access to the sap and nothing else can? Because you've got a high sugary sap, but it needs to have a proboscis, a beak-like structure that it can drill into the tree and suck out the sap and / resin that not many other creatures could do. So the tree is only feeding the phoenix butterfly. Also, having a beak is good because it now looks more like a bird.
Nah.
Its antenna, if you saw it, not that it would be humans at this point, but if it had antenna, the antenna would, you could say they switch back. Sometimes you see pictures of Phoenix, they have these plumes, these feathery plumes that come out the top of its head, which weirdly look like antenna that face backwards. I saw this picture and went, what's antenna? I went, my God, this all just making sense. Now, if it was big enough as well, for the oxygen side of things, as it pumped its wings, because the spiracles, like they don't have lungs. Insects don't have lungs. It still needs to get more oxygen. But by pumping of its chest, it could create bellows. If it had air sacs, it could be sucking more air in to its body. So in fact, it's bigger. And there are butterflies already that are hummingbird sized in our world that fly and look like hummingbirds. That's one of their defense mechanisms. Things that don't eat hummingbirds but do eat butterflies. It goes, oh, I'm a hummingbird, don't eat me. Same as the phoenix says, I'm a big orange thing, do not eat me, because that's dangerous. The world's like, bop, bop, danger. But also it moves like a bird, it doesn't move like a butterfly. So anything that came to eat a butterfly, even a large one, would go, hey, let's not mess with that. Like our dragonfly friend would be like, hey, don't eat that, it's a bird. But when it worked it out anyway, we go, don't eat that, because it will burst into flame. It's always a bad thing. I think the phoenix is a mutualistic butterfly that works with a resin-producing high-energy sap tree that makes seeds that need fire. It lives its life when it needs to die or is at that point or just needs to clear an area out. It lands, it sets itself on fire, creating a cocoon inside it that hardens, that there has stem cells in it and all the cells required. The baby then forms very quickly, pupates very quickly, and comes out and instantly latches onto the tree, which would still be there. Mm-hmm. Its fire hardened. Everything else is gone. So it's already got a set nursery ready to go, and the cycle continues forever. It could probably make it through its beaky noise. It could make some kind of horrible shriek as well. Like so elephant beetles, when they compress their thorax, they push air out its front, and it makes a ksh, ksh.
Yeah.
A meter across. You can go ksh, ksh. So it can also
sound like
scream.
Bellows.
Yeah, yeah. But you can make it a high-pitched screech noise as well. That's my idea of a cryptozoologically possible phoenix. Why humans think this is a thing that happened is because they've only ever found the fossilized beaks of these amazing birds, which actually are the proboscises of a butterfly.
That's lit.
There could be males, like a small number of males that could produce sexually with a female phoenix butterfly.
They can still just lay eggs. Like maybe it's just to continue on the individual so that they continue.
Well, parthenogenically, it's when there are no males around to mate with, they just mate. So maybe, right, maybe they just produce, and then if they can't, at a certain situation, they can light everything on fire, which would probably kill all the males as well. And maybe that's the whole thing. Maybe they attract males. Oh, that's a really interesting idea. Produces sexually, but then when they decide we have to burn the forest down, the females can survive because they can go through this process. The males are destroyed, and that means that new males have to come in from outside the population area, reducing the chances of inbreeding. And while you're waiting for more males to turn up, you parthenogenically clone yourself over and over again, because it may take forever, or it may be, you know, weeks to months before males from somewhere else turn up again.
Well, here's another thing that you haven't thought of, is that fires create updrafts, and updrafts make butterflies go up and spread further.
You actually think of that, of updrafts being a way for this large butterfly to be able to fly around under its own fire. But you're absolutely right. I didn't think of it as a way of sending females or males somewhere else. Maybe the females burn, and that allows the males to fly away. And on the updrafts, they go really, really high, and this kind of coast down to someone else's phoenix butterfly
area.
Spread
areas. That DNA everywhere. Yeah,
there you go. See, we've done it. We solved it. Put that at the end, Dan. Put this bit at the end. I think this is an important part, the spreading bit.
All right. You look a bit tired, Gregoire. And I know that there are some people who would mention your rampant insomnia or point that you are rapidly hurtling towards 50. But I think I know why you're so often tired. It's because you like being tired.
Ooh.
You like the sexy dark eyes that make you look like Robert Smith. And you know what makes me think that, Gregoire?
Oh, yes.
Because you actively avoid drinking the world's favorite drink, coffee.
Sasquatch, Bigfoot, who is
No.
Sorry, it sounds like that.
Coffee has, that's just, I'm just big. I'm just epic. I'm just leaving room, space for the orchestral flourish.
Right, good. Excellent.
Coffee has caffeine in it that wakes you up. And you can't risk it even for that delicious taste of what you affectionately call hot, dirty water. What if I told you, Gregoire, that you could enjoy the delights of never feeling truly awake and also enjoy the wonderful earthy taste?
Oh.
That's right. You say, what utopia have I found myself in?
I'm very excited, Dan. Yes, please, please.
Let me introduce you to the world of decaffeinated coffee.
Oh, my God. Isn't the caffeine the point?
Not for you. For you, you're trying to avoid it.
Oh, okay. It's a vasodilator. It gets all your blood pumping and all the parts that need blood pumping in.
And you don't want that. You want the dark eyes and the constant feeling of that you're being pulled down into the twilight.
True. Yep.
The coffee berry is harvested, and if you dunk it into water, the caffeine will dissolve into the water. So then you'd have a big pot with caffeine water and berry in it. You could take the berries out and dry them, and you'd have a caffeine-free coffee.
Good.
You would also have taste-free coffee, as while caffeine dissolves in water, so too do many of the flavonoids in coffee. Okay. What you do is you put those same berries, you put them into chemicals, not a hydrogen-oxygen blend like water, but other chemicals.
Can you just feed them to a cat? The whole sewer coffee, just feed it to a cat.
Well, that doesn't get rid of the caffeine.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, you can do that. The Frog Princess has had that coffee and she was very happy to drink it.
Oh, excellent. You're not into cats, though. That's the problem. The Frog Princess could have her own coffee machine that just wanders around the house and sleeps on the bed.
Gross. You could put these berries into methylene chloride or ethyl acetate. First, you soak the berries.
She used to be a vaudeville singer.
Ethyl acetate.
Ethyl acetate. She's like, I love chemistry, bananas are good for you. That was ethyl acetate.
Yeah. Amazing gams on that woman.
She surely was a great broad.
Firstly, you soak the berries at a temperature just below boiling point. Say about 370 kelvins. This makes them expand and become sponge-like. You then rinse them with either one of the two solvents that breaks down mostly the caffeine and leaves the rest of the components intact. You can then rinse off the solvents and dry and roast the beans. There might be a tiny bit of chemical remaining on the beans, but that chemical evaporates at fairly low temperatures. Now, if you don't want chemicals on your berries, there's another, solution.
Oh, very good.
You soak the berries in water and all the caffeine and flavonoids and sugars and oils separate into the water. Then your berries taste like garbage, but your water is lovely. You then mix the solvent into the broth. These solvents bind with the caffeine molecules. Then you raise the temperature just a little bit and the solvents evaporate, taking the caffeine molecule with it. So the caffeine molecule is the only molecule that evaporates up into the air.
Could you sell the experience of when it's being made? You just have people who are addicts just come to our cafe,
just snorting it.
Aerosolized caffeine room. And it's just above. It's just this room. You sit in this, just get the air conditioner there. As you go into the office.
There's a guard at the door and he's like so heightened that he's shot like six people since January.
Just vibrating.
Gotta be aware.
I'll never sleep again.
Okay, so at this point, you've got a solution of all the parts of the coffee bean that you like without any of the parts that you don't. You reintroduce the beans in and concentrate the solution and hopefully restore as much of that taste to the beans as possible. There's the next method, which is the Swiss water method. There's no chemicals required. And this is quite a popular method these days.
You just feed it to a Swiss person, follow them around the jungle, eat their poop.
That's not it.
Okay, damn it.
You take some beans and dissolve all of the stuff into pure water. Then you take the beans out and you throw the beans away. Fantastic. You then have your caffeine solution. You run that solution through a carbon filter, which strips out the caffeine molecules physically. The filter is put into a furnace that makes sure those nasty caffeine molecules can never hurt anyone ever again. Now you've got a solution that still has all the oils and sugars and taste, but it's missing the caffeine. You get some new beans, you soak them in this solution. The oils and sugars and flavonoids are all in balance, so they aren't drawn out into the solution, but there is an imbalance in the caffeine, so the caffeine is drawn into the solution.
Okay.
Now the beans.
It's very complicated to take out the reason that people want to drink coffee. That's fine. Very complicated.
Well, is it, you are not bonding with the whole point of the.
No, I'm with you. The conceit of this is that you want to drink coffee, but you don't want the caffeine. I understand that.
You keep undermining the conceit.
I don't mean to undermine it. I'm just trying to say, I'm just fascinated that someone, this to me feels like the same thing when someone goes, I want to drink beer without alcohol. I'm like, why are you drinking that then? But it's because they like
the yeast taste.
Yes, and I know, and there it is. And there it is. And I've met someone recently. I made this comment to someone else that wasn't aware of. I made this comment before, and they were like, I love having an alcohol-free beer. It makes me, I love the taste. I enjoy the ritual of it. I was like, I'm sorry, you're right. So I understand. It just seems weird to me that someone would want to drink this, but you're right. People do. It's a thing. I apologize. And also, I need it so I can retain my Robert Smith-like looks. Yeah. Are you talking young Robert Smith or older Robert Smith?
Look, that's up to you, Mr. I'm almost 50.
And my diet. That's right. Sure.
All right.
Please, I apologize.
So in this Swiss water method, we've got it up to the point where we've filtered the caffeine out and then we've put more beans in. And because everything's in the water that's in the beans, except for the caffeine gets drawn out. Now your beans are basically the same as they were before, but without the caffeine. They get dried and roasted and the solution has the caffeine filtered out and incinerated, ready for the next batch of beans. It gets reused for multiple batches of beans. So you're kind of moving the flavonoids from the last set of beans, from the first set of beans into the next set of beans.
Can you take that caffeine-filled water and put it in more beans and infuse it back into those beans? They're like double caffeine beans.
Why don't I talk to you about the final method?
Ooh.
There is one final method with a chemical we all love here on planet Earth, carbon dioxide.
Nah, it warms my heart.
I've got some in my mouth right now. Wouldn't it be great if we could soak the berries in carbon dioxide? It's a very effective solvent for caffeine, and under the right conditions, it doesn't touch any of the other carbohydrates and peptides. Mm. But if you try to use it at room temperature, it won't work, Gregoire. Yeah. Gas is too light. So you drop the temperature to turn it into a liquid, and that doesn't work either, Gregoire. You know what happens?
What happens?
Turns into dry ice.
Oh, what?
I just want the liquid bit.
And I'm
ripped off. It's like physics itself is trying to keep you from this lovely drink. But physics also gives you a way to circumvent this problem, Gregoire.
High pressure. Yes.
If you increase the pressure, you can turn carbon dioxide into a fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Keep increasing the pressure and it becomes super critical.
Yep. Absolutely.
This kind of means it's both a liquid and a solid at the same time.
Ugh.
It allows this fluid to be fine-tuned to target just the caffeine molecules. Then you remove the supercritical carbon dioxide fluid, let it depressurize and turn it back into a gas.
Right.
Most of the caffeine drops out and they send the CO2 through a filter and start the process again. They can take that caffeine and put it into energy drinks.
Oh, my goodness. It's just liquid. It's just pure liquid caffeine at the bottom of the tank.
All those monster energy drinks are like the leftover caffeine from decaf coffee.
Oh, there you go. Okay, so it's not being – wow, okay. They don't tell you that, do they? They always say it's full of taurine, but not – man, if someone said to me – this has been through supercritical carbon dioxide. I'd be like, give me more of that.
Yeah. That's the name of the drink, supercritical.
There you go. Smarter, better producers. Supercritical. A can of this will kill you.
It's a liquid and a solid. Careful when opening the can.
That's right. Once you drink it, what you produce will also be a liquid and a solid. You won't be able to stop. Oh, sweet Jesus, get medical help soon. $9.95 a bottle. Look, that's the ad.
We're done. We just need to make the product
itself.
Now.
It sells itself.
This process is the perfect process for decaffeinating coffee, but it requires a pretty intense setup. Thus, you need to be processing an enormous amount of beans to make it worthwhile. And the companies that process that amount of coffee are the big name brands who make the worst generic coffee. If this process could get into the hands of boutique coffee vendors, you could have some very nice decaf coffee. But at the moment, you have to scale up too much for that to happen.
At the moment, science finds a way.
So there you go, Gregoire. You can enjoy hot, dirty water and rest easy, ha, that it won't wake you up from the twilight existence you love so much.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate that. That's lovely. I'd like to point out that coffee, I think, offends me the most about coffee. And I mean offends. I'm not using hyperbole there. It offends me. Is that it smells like amazingness. The aroma of coffee, freshly brewed coffee, I get it, everyone. Coffee smells just perfect. And then when you drink it, you're like, that is not what it smells like in any way, shape, or form. They are not connected. It is a liar. Coffee is a liar. Don't truck with liars.
It's like those moist towelettes at KFC.
They don't taste like KFC at all.
They smell like lemonade. They do not taste like lemonade. You have been listening to Dan at smartenough.org.
Also Greg at smartenough.org.
If you would like to do anything relating to the podcast, get along to the website, smartenough.org, where there are subscription buttons and there are donation buttons and all that sort of stuff. You can chat, you can make a comment on our comment system. We encourage that. If you've heard any mistakes made, and Greg, let's say if Greg's made a mistake, send an email to dan@smartenough.org and then I can bring it up on the Walk of Shame.
And if you're not too sure that ethyl acetate was actually a vaudevillian singer, send that to dan@smartenough.org.
If you would like to subscribe to our Patreon, then we encourage that too. In fact, it's expected.
We're into that. That's right. It's required now.
Yes, it's required. We thank our level two patrons. Big thank you to Steve Stewart, Andrew Trousdale, Britta Rogowski, Catherine Cook, Avi Greenbury, Ivan, Lindsay Jenkinson, Matt Ewers, Mariana Scott, Andrew Potts, Matthew Toy, Gronya Maguire, Gary Heather, Andrew Whitehurst, Ilana Mitchell, and Liz Y. Thank you all so much for being level two patrons.
Thank you. That's very kind. Good Lord. Real human monies. Amazing.
Level three patrons for their sins get abused by me. So, because I haven't done anything except for play Satisfactory, these insults are related to oil processing. So, Rick Lepoidovin, you are unrefined.
Oh, mm-hmm. Very good.
Scott Driscoll, you have all the sexual allure of a side cut stripper. A side cut stripper is a mechanism in the processing of petroleum products.
No, cool, good. Excellent.
Steve Eichenhout, you are a crude oil cracker. I think that's quite a good one, Greg.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That sounds like something I should be in real trouble for.
Yeah, sure.
Calling a black man an oil cracker isn't an unacceptable slur, but it sure sounds like it should be.
I see. And thank you for belaboring the
Tom
point.
Tom Seary, you are ruining the local environment at an accelerated rate.
And all of them are aromatic compounds.
So thank you so much to those guys. Also, a big thank you to Joey Wesley, Eric Wilson, Al Batson, Morden O'Hare, and Michael Barnes. You gentlemen are a pure gas.
Ooh.
Thank you, everyone who gave us money in any fashion. Yeah,
it's crazy.
And all those people who write in. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. We love hearing from you. You don't even have to write to us and like an aging aunt slip $5 into the envelope. I mean, just the fact you write to us is amazing. Thank you.
And get along and comment at the website.
Yeah.
That's a thing. I put a lot of work into that.
Yeah.
It's very quiet. I'm so lonely. Please make a comment.
If you've got any ideas, put them in there. The things you might want us to work on or any weird ideas you had, or you just want to say hi. Just come in and say hi.
And as we always like to say,
the best cat is a coffee machine that sleeps on your bed.
Oh, here's a question that I should have asked myself decades ago. I'm going to find out what the answer is. The answer was really hard to find. I'm like, yeah. Is this a simple question? I should be able to find this. I'm reading through dissertations trying to find, I'm going, here's two lines that actually back up what I think is happening.
Reverse causality, and therefore you destroy time and space. No.
I can only destroy space. I haven't figured out how to destroy time yet.
So I want to see the capybaras. So I'm very excited.
They have capybaras now.
Yeah, they're capybaras. I'm like, woo.
Fucking hate capybaras.
No.
So fucking calm.
Yeah, that's why I love them.
So I'm like, fucking calm. They're hiding something.
From them. Oh my God. King of rodents, man. King of the rodents.